In fact, the worse it does, the more funding it is likely to get. Exactly the opposite of what happens in the private sector, in which those who successfully meet the needs of their fellow men are rewarded with profits, and those who poorly anticipate consumer demand are punished with losses. Take arts funding, for example. Some Americans appear to believe that there would be no arts in America were it not for the National Endowment for the Arts, NEA, an institution created in 1965. They cannot imagine things being done any other way, even though they were done another way throughout our country's existence and throughout most of mankind's history. While the government requested $121 million for the NEA in 2006, private donations to the arts totaled $2.5 billion that year, dwarfing the NEA budget. The NEA represents a tiny fraction of all arts funding, a fact few Americans realize. Freedom works, after all, and that money is almost certainly better spent than government money. NEA funds go not necessarily to the best artists, but to people who happen to be good at filling out government grant applications. I have my doubts that the same people populate both categories. Alexis de Tocqueville was very impressed when he visited our country in the 19th century to see how many voluntary associations Americans had formed in order to achieve common goals. The political associations which exist in the United States are only a single feature in the myths of the immense assemblage of associations in that country, he wrote. Wherever, at the head of some new undertaking, you see the government in France or a man of rank in England, in the United States, you will be sure to find an association. De Tocqueville admired the extreme skill with which the inhabitants of the United States succeed in proposing a common object to the exertions of a great many men and in getting them voluntarily to pursue it. That may be all well and good for the arts and the like, some may say, but private efforts could never substitute for gigantic government budgets for various forms of welfare. But private assistance would not need to match these budgets dollar for dollar. As much as 70% of welfare budgets have been eaten up by bureaucracy. Moreover, government programs are far more easily abused, and the money they dispense more readily becomes a destructive habit than with more local or private forms of assistance. Why would we expect a system based on legal plunder, as ours is, to be a net benefit to the poor or middle class in whose name so many government schemes are enacted? Every one of the special benefits, on behalf of which hundreds of millions of dollars are expended on lobbyists every year, makes goods more expensive, companies less efficient and competitive, and the economy more sluggish. Given that the politically influential and well-connected, neither of which includes the middle class or the poor, are the ones who tend to win privileges and loot from government, I do not understand why we take for granted that the net result of all this looting is good for those who are lower on the economic ladder. And when the loot is paid for by printing money and causing inflation, which, as I show in the chapter on money, disproportionately harms the most vulnerable, the suggestion that the least prosperous are helped by all this intervention collapses into outright farce. To get an appreciation for the difference between public and private administration in terms of bureaucracy and cost-effectiveness, consider this. The Brookings Institution's John Chubb once investigated the number of bureaucrats working in the central administration offices of the New York City public schools. Six telephone calls finally yielded someone who knew the answer, but that person was not allowed to disclose it. Another six calls later, Chubb had at last pinned down someone who knew the answer and could tell him what it was. There were 6,000 bureaucrats working in the central office. Then Chubb called the Archdiocese of New York to find out the figure there. The city's Catholic schools educated one-fifth as many students as did the government-run schools. Chubb's first telephone call was taken by someone who did not know the answer. Here we go again, he thought. But after a moment, she said, "Wait a minute, let me count." Her answer, 26.